Welcome to Pomegranate Health, and the second part of our series on the political economy of global public health. I'm Mick Cavazzini for the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. In the previous episode, we heard how the defining convention of the World Health Organization had held up in response to COVID-19. Today, I want to use the pandemic as a prompt to focus on the pharmaceutical market, given some of the bizarre events we've seen along the way. Remember back in April, as the worldwide death toll from COVID had reached 100,000? One of the first glimmers of good news to emerge was a study showing that remdesivir increased rate of recovery in severely ill patients. Almost immediately, the USA alarmed the global community by buying the entire stock of the drug for 3 months from manufacturer Gilead Sciences. And this was already after the administration had raised the heckles of the German government for trying to lure the vaccine manufacturer CureVac to US soil. Then in June, the findings from a British trial showed that the corticosteroid dexamethasone could reduce mortality in ventilated patients by a third. The drug was already off patent and production was ramped up pretty easily, but it didn't stop the price of the drug almost tripling in some parts of the world. And by mid-July, there were promising results from phase 1 vaccine trials against SARS-CoV-2, as the virus is known. One conducted by the Oxford Vaccine Group with AstraZeneca, and the other by US firm Moderna. But these were soon followed by reports that Russian and Chinese hackers had tried to get access to research data, and you started to wonder if we were destined for a kind of Mad Max free-for-all. On a more positive note, 172 member states of the World Health Organization came together behind the COVAX facility in response to calls for a people's vaccine that would be available to all free of charge. Will this globalist spirit be strong enough to counter the vaccine nationalism we've seen so far? For a successful vaccine to be produced affordably, leading pharma companies would have to give up intellectual property of their discoveries to generic manufacturers. In a minute, we'll unpack some of the laws that govern patents and commerce in this industry. But here are some first impressions of the stage set by COVID-19 from RACP fellow Peter Hill in Brisbane. He's joined by visiting collaborator Dr. Owen Williams.
I'm Peter Hill. I'm a public health physician and academic, recently retired from the School of Public Health at the University of Queensland. My main research career is centred around the translation of global policies, usually into low and middle income country contexts.
I'm Dr. Owen Williams. I'm at the School of Politics and International Studies at the University of Leeds, UK. My area is the political economy of health, including pharmaceuticals.
To my mind, I think the COVID story is unprecedented. Now, that's a neologism that you can use any time. In terms of vaccines, I don't think we've had anything quite like this before. I think the latest count was somewhere around 230 variants. And, you know, if we look at analogous situations, malaria, we've been hunting for a vaccine for absolute decades and always expecting it to come in the next 10 years. Mm. HIV, surprisingly, hasn't made progress in terms of a vaccine option. I think it's the convergence of a number of things. It's primarily affected high-income countries initially, which is a very different context to what we've seen in previous epidemics that threatened to become pandemics. And of course, geopolitically, we're in a very interesting time.
So Mick, to get vaccines in phase 3 trials within the space of 6 months of a novel outbreak is pretty extraordinary in terms of global effort, and I suppose to be applauded. But on the other hand, we see the embedded market failures in medicines really multiplying. So, you know, the price of masks, the failure in India at present with regards to supplies of medical oxygen, and the two drugs that you mentioned, where you've seen huge price gouging and stockpiling. And it's quite extraordinary that we've placed so much blind faith in markets for drugs and vaccines, and they routinely fail. And when I say fail, I'm not using market failure in the neoclassical economic sense. I'm talking about wider failures, markets failing to provide public and welfare goods.
Patent law goes back further than you'd think. In 1421, the architect Brunelleschi, famous for the freestanding dome on the Cathedral of Florence, was granted a 3-year patent for a novel barge that could hoist marble blocks on and off. Not long after, the Republic of Venice also started to formally recognize the unique skills of artisan glassmakers on the island of Murano. By the end of the 1700s, laws protecting architectural and industrial designs were reasonably common in the Western world. Pharmaceutical patents, however, are a very modern phenomenon. Into the 1970s, they were available only in the US, Britain, France, and West Germany, budesonide being an early example. Patents gave the originator exclusivity over sale in these countries, so that they could recover the costs of development and profit from their discovery. But in any other country, you could have legally made a generic version of the drug and sold it as cheaply as you wanted. States were concerned that granting monopolies to manufacturers would drive up drug costs for government health budgets. One by one, however, countries began to recognize that drug patents might be necessary to attract investors to the risky process of research and development. This concept became cemented into the World Trade Organization's 1995 convention, the Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights, or TRIPS. This governed everything from copyright on books and music records, to patents for industrial designs and plant varieties. Also trademarks, and those geographical denominations which mean that a bubbly white wine from the Barossa Valley is definitely not champagne. And for the first time, all member states of the WTO would have to give 20-year patent protections for novel pharmaceutical compounds. According to Owen Williams, this represented a real shift in the way drug therapies were thought of.
Up until the 1970s, drugs were considered as public welfare goods. And the reward for inventing and manufacturing them was, I don't want to make grand claims here, but pretty much decoupled from price. And, you know, that reflects the historic funding of drug and vaccine research by states. That's the way I'd capture it. Now, that gets changed completely. And then you get a slow but steady ratchet upwards of levels of protection. 20 year, in the case of TRIPS, is a time-bound monopoly. And that confers on you the rights to be a price setter.
Yes, yeah, yeah. The signing of the TRIPS agreement in 1995 coincided with the peak incidence of deaths to HIV/AIDS, but in some of the hardest hit countries like South Africa, the price of therapies was out of reach for most people. So in 2001, the Doha Declaration was hashed out, which stated that, and I quote, "The TRIPS agreement does not and should not prevent members from taking measures to protect public health." And when the declaration was later accepted, it introduced some flexibilities to the TRIPS agreement. Can you explain these, and particularly how compulsory licenses work?
Doha was a product of really exceptional coalitions of gay rights activists, clinicians, human rights lawyers, really howling in the face of price gouging by pharma. You know, at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, a course of antiretrovirals would cost $10,000 per person per year. And of course, that placed badly needed antiretroviral treatments outside of the hands of people who required them. So call it what you like, but that's a market failure. And of course, underlying this was the fact that you had the potential for generic versions of these ARVs to be produced. And indeed, in the run-up to Doha, president of one of the big Indian manufacturers, Cipla, famously offered to the European Parliament the price of $1 a day.
Hmm.
Yeah. So what Doha did is reconfirmed existing exceptions that are always present in historically in patent law. And one of the key exceptions is public health emergency. And one of the key mechanisms is the issue of a compulsory license. Now, it's a negotiated arrangement in which the license producer returns a set agreed sum to the originator firm. That's what a compulsory license is.
Let me jump in here to elaborate a bit more. Pharma companies will sometimes negotiate voluntary licenses with generic manufacturers in peripheral markets. But when those negotiations fall down, a government can permit that domestic manufacturer to go ahead, even without the permission of the patent owner. According to a WTO document, countries are free to determine the grounds for granting compulsory licenses and to determine what constitutes a national emergency. The local authorities are also free to decide what adequate remuneration for the patent holder should be, although there is a right of appeal. Okay, back to the interview. And it was recognised at the time that even with that flexibility to grant compulsory licences, most states, most countries don't have the manufacturing capability of their own to make use of this flexibility. So it wasn't until January 2017, I believe, that a quorum of WTO members accepted an amendment that would allow countries in this boat to import generics from India, say.
That's correct, yeah. Yeah.
And in the same year, you published a case study of drug pricing in the journal Globalization and Health.
Yes, correct,
Where you looked at the parallel importing. Specifically, you looked at sofosbuvir from Gilead Sciences, a direct-acting antiviral for treating hepatitis C. It cures over 90% of cases and is much better tolerated than older interferon-based drugs. But the price of a 12-week course of treatment in the US is over $84,000, depending on the formulation. However, in the African countries you looked at, Gilead was offering a tiered price, something like $1,200 for a full course.
That's right.
That's a massive discount, which seems, on the face of it, pretty generous. How does that arrangement or middle ground come about?
You know, what this price discount in tiered pricing does for pharma, it's got a number of functions. One of the key functions, it's good corporate PR. It's good corporate social responsibility. They gain a lot from it. But the really important underlying function, as far as I'm concerned, is it legitimizes the patent system more generally, and it undercuts generic competition.
Well, you talk about competing or undermining the generic market. To their credit, Gilead did also grant voluntary licenses to several companies in India to make a generic version of sofosbuvir for export to these low-income countries. And the generic was being sold for around $700 in the countries you studied.
Yeah.
But even at that price, you concluded that it would be an astronomical burden for the countries to reach the WHO's target of 80% of patients treated.
Completely, completely. I can't remember the figures offhand.
I think for Egypt and Nigeria, it was a quarter of their total health expenditure.
Yeah.
For Rwanda, it was half. And for Cameroon, it would be three quarters.
Now, that's just, you know, that's not going to happen. There's other disease burdens. There's other needs in the health system. You wouldn't be paying staff, let alone other medicines and vaccines.
It also foreshadows the kind of problems we'll have if we do have, you know, a COVID vaccine that requires two doses, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Logistics of national coverage is going to bring with it the same kind of challenges. This is not going to be something that the average low or middle-income country is going to be able to accommodate easily in its health budget.
Interestingly, you can get generics of sofosbuvir in India for around $530 a course, and in Pakistan, where Gilead hadn't lodged a primary patent at all, it costs as little as $150.
Really?
Yes, I just found that on a market website in Pakistan. So what's going on here in this particular example? Has Gilead controlled specifically who is licensed to send generics to Africa and still set the price at a floor that they can tolerate rather than, you know.
Look, I'll be somewhat glib about this. I think if they can guarantee sales in their core markets and core middle-income markets at a good price, they don't really care about the peripheral markets.
Mm-hmm.
You have to recognize that something like 40% of the global market for drugs is in the United States. You add then to that 38% being in Europe. And then you add on to that the outliers like Japan, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, takes you up to about 86% of the market. I mean, Africa represents about 1% or 2% of the global market. So it's a peripheral market.
Mm.
You can see that they're not really, you know, it's gouging in the extreme to deny these regions cheaper generic drugs.
I think Gilead is still doing okay. Sofosbuvir formulations generated over $50 billion US dollars in sales up to the end of 2017.
So they've done all right out of that one, and they will continue to do all right out of it. 2012, they got the patent. So they've got a healthy 10 years patent monopoly on that. And yet you've got hardly any way in terms of eliminating the disease. Mm-hmm. We're not even halfway there. I mean, it's just absurd in welfare terms, in human rights terms. I remember talking to the guy who wrote the industry proposal for the United States, which kind of formed the basis of what we ended up with in the TRIPS agreement. Very interesting man called Jacques Gaulin. And he took me out for lunch once. And he's a very charming, entertaining man, but it's like having dinner with the devil for me. And he said, we couldn't believe we got away with it. We just thought everybody would push back. And it was for us what in negotiation you call an ambit claim. You know, we'd ask for this absurdly high level of protection, 20 years, you know, process and product patents, biotech patents, gene patents. We'd ask for all of this and we'd get half of what we set out to get. And we ended up with the lot.
We'll talk about research and development costs in the next episode, but let's agree that pharmaceutical companies do pretty well out of the 20-year patents under TRIPS. That hasn't stopped them from lobbying for even further protections in many other free trade agreements since 1995. You probably heard the Trans-Pacific Partnership discussed heatedly in the press a few years ago. The TPP was hashed out over 5 years of secretive negotiations between 12 countries, rich ones like the US, Canada, and Japan, and lower-income countries like Peru, Vietnam, and Brunei. Australia and New Zealand were at the table too. Before the TPP was even signed, however, a newly elected Donald Trump immediately bailed out of the agreement, calling it a bad deal, agreed on by guess who. But it was actually a very good deal for US pharmaceutical companies, by virtue of provisions such as patent extension and secondary patents. Why patent extensions? Well, after a drug patent is filed, there are often delays before it's accepted by a registration body like the TGA, MedSafe, or the FDA. This will eat away at the 20-year market monopoly, so the pharma companies argued that they deserve to be compensated with a few extra years of exclusivity. Even though this provision was dropped from the final version of the TPP as it stands now, Australia actually has an extension of term clause in its Patent Act already. In a federal government review from 2013, the authors found that patent extensions had delayed the entry of generics into the Australian market and added a cost of around $240 million to the PBS the previous financial year. The authors also concluded that it hadn't attracted more pharmaceutical research to Australia as intended, since even firms that had conducted most of the research overseas had benefited from this windfall. Another common allowance in trade agreements is for secondary patents. This is where a company modifies a formulation so that it's now in a gel cap rather than a pill, say. Maybe they add another active ingredient or find some new indication. Any of these tweaks might be enough to get another few years of exclusivity on the molecule. In a 2013 study in PLOS Medicine, researchers found that the 15 costliest drugs in Australia had an average of 49 patents associated with each of them. AstraZeneca's omeprazole had 121 patents on its own, again, thanks to rules that predate the Trans-Pacific Partnership. These layers of IP protection are described as patent thickets and are a daunting obstacle to any manufacturer of generics, according to Deborah Gleason from the School of Public Health at La Trobe University. On behalf of the Public Health Association of Australia, she advocated against increased patent protections in the TPP.
Companies tend to use secondary patents as a way of kind of protecting their investment past the end of the, you know, the 20 or 25 year patent term, and making it much more difficult for generic companies to negotiate their way through all of those patents. You know, litigation is very expensive and time consuming. And so patent law in Australia and in many other countries have a low standard for inventiveness. So you don't have to demonstrate that, you know, something very new, very novel. It just has to be an incremental change to the status quo, essentially.
And again, there was a provision within the Trans-Pacific Partnership that guaranteed originators that any clinical trial data they submitted to a registration body could remain undisclosed. Normally, the TGA would use these same data to rule on the quality and safety of a generic version of the drug. But with the exclusivity rule, other firms would need to replicate the data. And you say that this hurdle to reinvent the wheel could remain in place even after the patent itself has expired?
So essentially, even if a vaccine, say, is not under patent, it can still get 5 years of monopoly based on the clinical trial data. So this is a potential obstacle to compulsory licensing. So even if a compulsory license is issued, data exclusivity may still protect that product. The US tried to extend that 5-year period for biologic products in the TPP. We could have had more difficulty getting access to biosimilar medicines, which include vaccines. But there was a lot of resistance from the other countries and a very big global movement by health and humanitarian organisations against that type of extension of monopoly periods for biologics.
There's a study you refer to in that 2018 article for global social policy. After Jordan signed an agreement with the US in 2001, data exclusivity delayed the availability of generic versions of 79% of medicines launched thereafter, and caused a 17% increase in medicine expenditure. There are similar findings in Central America after the signing of the CAFTA agreement. So it's not just Australian consumers who'd have to pay a bit more for their drugs. The real losers from the new provisions of the TPP would be the low-income partners to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so Chile, Vietnam, Brunei. In one statement, Médecins Sans Frontières said the TPP will go down in history as the worst trade agreement for access to medicines in developing countries. Can you explain that a bit?
So in developing countries that don't have schemes like the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, you know, people on low incomes can face catastrophic costs for medicines if they have to buy the patented version. But there's also the issue of the administrative and human resource costs of actually implementing a whole lot of rules around intellectual property rights. And this, for small countries with very limited health budgets and very limited government budgets overall, this can be a really significant impost, you know, and can really reduce the amount of funding there is to go around.
It's not just the US that has written these so-called TRIPS Plus provisions into its trade agreements, but the EU and Japan too, which have their own pharma industries to protect. As Deborah Gleason has written, this represents the failure of wealthy countries to successfully prosecute their agenda through multilateral forums. That's to say that the World Trade Organization is like a classroom, where everyone gets to speak in turn. But after class, the new kid in school gets cornered in the corridor and bullied into giving up his lunch money for the prospect of making new friends. Or in this case, the promise of new export markets. Public health is inextricable from diplomacy. And WHO researchers have shown that even those developing countries that would be eligible to make use of compulsory licensing often encounter many obstacles and threats. A sting that's common to many trade agreements are investor-state dispute settlements. ISDS provisions enable foreign corporations to sue a government for compensation at an international tribunal if they think their investment has been harmed by that country's domestic laws. It was through these that cigarette manufacturer Philip Morris challenged Australia's plain packaging law. Another infamous case was that of Novartis versus the Colombian government around the production of the chemotherapy imatinib, marketed as Glivec by the Swiss firm since 2001. Imatinib can reverse the death sentence of chronic myeloid leukemia for many patients. That's if they can afford lifelong therapy. A Colombian firm had been making a generic version until Novartis obtained a patent in that country in 2012. It now would cost $20,000 US for a year of treatment,
four times the previous price, and twice the average annual income in Colombia. Since negotiations weren't going anywhere, the government issued a compulsory license for the generic. Novartis in turn threatened an ISDS tribunal, arguing that Colombia had violated legitimate expectations from an existing trade deal. Eventually, the two parties agreed to meet halfway, so adamant was Novartis not to concede a compulsory license. In 2015, the World Health Organization added imatinib to its list of essential medicines. These are the drugs deemed to be necessary for a functioning health system at all times, and which should be available at prices affordable to individuals and the community. This has done nothing for CML patients in the US, however, where imatinib costs an eye-watering $92,000 every year. As a result, fewer than a quarter of patients in that country end up receiving treatment. Nevertheless, Gleevec brought in $4.7 billion to Novartis in the year 2012 and accounted for 10% of the firm's revenue. But the US couldn't start importing generic imatinib even if it wanted to. It's just one of 37 higher-income countries that volunteered to forego access to the TRIPS flexibilities when the Doha Declaration was put into practice. They promised never to override primary patents by manufacturing or importing generics. But desperate times call for desperate measures. In April this year, Dr. Gleason was one of 45 academics, along with Joseph Stiglitz of World Bank fame, who wrote an open letter to ask that those WTO members walk back this commitment in response to the sheer scale of the COVID-19 pandemic.
We called for the governments who waived their rights to import medicines under compulsory license from other countries to revoke that voluntary waiver that they made many years ago, when the conditions that we face now in a global pandemic were probably not front of mind. So an example might be the drug remdesivir, which is a treatment for COVID-19. And Gilead Sciences has priced remdesivir at over $3,000 Australian for a 5-day course of treatment for developed countries. Now, although Gilead has issued voluntary licenses to a number of companies in India, Pakistan, and Egypt, those companies are only permitted to supply low and some middle-income countries. Now, Gilead Sciences has only limited manufacturing capacity. So it would make sense for Australia, in a situation where we can't actually get access to the product from Gilead Sciences, to be able to issue a compulsory license to import generic copies of remdesivir from India, for example. So Cipla has agreed to manufacture remdesivir for $66 for a course of treatment. We already have provisions in our Patents Act to enable patents to be overridden. So the government can issue a compulsory license or use the Crown use provisions in situations where there's a public health emergency. Earlier in the COVID-19 pandemic, Canada decided to introduce emergency legislation to waive the requirement to negotiate with the patent owner before issuing a compulsory license. And that's something that Australia could consider doing in order to speed up that process. I mean, basically, we have that mechanism. It's about whether there's the political will to use it.
This isn't intended to be a beat up on Gilead Sciences. Corporate interests will always take advantage of the regulatory loopholes left open to them. And Gilead just happens to provide some current examples of this. Take the Orphan Drug Act in the US, which is supposed to stimulate attention to rare diseases when there is little expectation that costs would be recouped. Among the incentives offered are large tax credits on clinical trial costs, 7 years of exclusivity on a given indication, and additional research funding from the Federal Drug Administration. Remdesivir already had a similar designation in Europe for treatment of Ebola patients. In March, Gilead Sciences secured orphan drug status for the use of remdesivir against COVID-19, because at that time it met the criterion of a rare disease that affected fewer than 200,000 people in the country, however briefly. After a backlash from civil society groups, Gilead walked back its additional monopoly claims on the drug. As Deborah Gleason said before, Gilead Sciences has permitted parallel distribution of generic remdesivir to 127 mainly low-income countries, and this is to be applauded. But Owen Williams writes that middle-income countries with great inequity are the ones hardest hit, because they're ineligible for tiered pricing. South Africa and Brazil, for example, rank first and eighth on the World Bank's estimates of income inequality, and a quarter of South Africa's population lives below the poverty line. While that proportion is lower in Brazil, 11 million people have had to sacrifice other essential household purchases to cover the costs of healthcare. Both these countries do have respectable public healthcare systems, but the inflation of drug prices strains national budgets too. Remdesivir is just one of many existing therapies that aren't readily accessible to most people who need them. The WHO estimates that 80% of the world's population lives in places with little or no access to pain medications, and more than 2 million children die each year from vaccine-preventable diseases. Letting the market solve these problems hasn't worked because the demand and the supply side of the equation are so mismatched. One way to redress this balance on behalf of lower-income countries has been through pooled procurement mechanisms. These are large collaborations between governments and philanthropic organisations that represent millions of potential patients across the developing world. One success story is Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, which went to tender for 2 billion doses of pneumococcal vaccine spread over 10 years and set a price cap of $3.50 per dose. Pharma companies flocked in for a piece of the $1.5 billion contract that was underwritten by the World Bank. Here's Owen Williams again.
I mean, look, the vaccine market is a fairly exceptional market. The model is volume, high volume, low price. And, you know, the upshot of that is a lot of the big pharma companies have retreated from the vaccine market.
Right.
And yet, you know, you can still make money. I mean, whether you're a generic firm, that is the generic model, or a big pharma operator, one of the big four left in the vaccine market, you'll still make money out of it. Advanced market commitments are the magic bullet because they, you know, you've got guaranteed sales. So you can produce according to what those commitments are. So it's perfect for producers. You know you can gear your production line. You know that you're going to need in 2021, you know that you will be receiving X billion dollars for your MMR or pneumococcal vaccine, and you just crank it out. You know, that's money in the bank. There's no innovation involved in this, incidentally. You know, there's no innovation.
Well, there's two sides of it. I mean, you wrote in the journal Global Public Health that, yes, UNICEF is responsible for 40% of the world vaccine purchasing. So that is the volume you talk about of vaccines that have already been developed. But these kinds of public-private partnerships have also contributed to new product development. For example, in 2018, the Medicines for Malaria venture and GlaxoSmithKline came out with tafenoquine, which is the first single-dose medication against Plasmodium vivax. And the TB Alliance now has a combination therapy for the treatment of extensively drug-resistant or multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. So those development pipelines exist, but are they financially sustainable, or do they constantly need topping up from big donors like the World Bank?
Yes, they do. They require bankrolling. That's fine. I mean, that's a good thing. But, you know, these product development partnerships have increasingly also had to coordinate. One of the key areas of coordination is not just in terms of data, but it's in terms of patent thickets. And these patent thickets are dense, you know, different companies owning key platforms or processes or components. So, you know, there's multiple interests and intellectual property rights that are variously required in developing new treatments. And a lot of these product development partnerships, one of the key things that they're doing is negotiating that mess.
While drug molecules can be easily cooked up in industrial labs in many parts of the world, vaccines are much too complex. They're often carefully folded proteins that have to be cultivated in chicken eggs or in cell cultures. But many of the biotechnology steps in the pathway, the reagents or even the cell lines involved, might have IP protections of their own. For example, Australia's CSL, formerly the Commonwealth Serum Laboratories, will need to acquire the adenovirus technology from AstraZeneca if it's to produce their COVID vaccine locally. And the Moderna candidate is an mRNA-based vaccine, which is an even more niche technology that hasn't been approved in humans before. I just want to highlight another important distinction around funding models. As Owen Williams has said, there have been some impressive examples of procurement mechanisms for churning out existing vaccines on a massive scale. But it's a lot harder to get funding together to bank on research for new drugs and vaccines, if they're for diseases that predominantly affect the developing world. Translational and clinical research are both costly, and vaccine trials especially so, because you need big numbers to demonstrate prevention of infrequent outcomes. On average, only 7% of vaccines in the preclinical stage make it to market, and even by the time you get to clinical trials, the rate of success is still barely 20%. Given these odds, pharma companies prefer to focus on the markets that can pay. They research high-cost chemotherapies, or drugs for common lifestyle diseases like cardiovascular disease and diabetes, even though these represent only 10% of the global disease burden. It's remarkable, therefore, how many have gotten behind the call for a people's vaccine to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. COVAX has already got 15 vaccine candidates in its portfolio, including the AstraZeneca and Moderna candidates now in phase 3. In earlier stages of clinical testing are others from the University of Queensland, from CureVac in Germany, from Clover Biopharmaceuticals in China, and from Inovio and Novavax in the USA. COVAX represents 172 countries and is supported by various philanthropic organisations and global health bodies like Gavi and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. Participation in COVAX is essentially like a lotto pool. Rather than put your money all on one ticket, you share the risk on several different contenders. While rich countries pay for entry, those that can't will still be looked after. The initial target is for 2 billion doses by the end of 2021, enough to vaccinate 3% of the population of every participating country in the first round. Successive rounds would bring vaccine coverage up to 20%, and some originator firms have already agreed for their vaccine to be produced at scale through the Serum Institute of India. The question is whether COVAX is a beacon of goodwill that will diffuse the vaccine nationalism and ruthless IP protection that has come before it. Here's Peter Hill describing just how peculiar this partnership is.
What strikes me as being interesting was that the most significant investment in this area that we had seen prior to COVID was Gavi using this as a way to stimulate development of vaccines that otherwise would not have had a real commercial attraction to the major pharmaceuticals. And whilst the mechanism may be the same, the motivation and the kind of the economic impulse underneath them was really quite different.
Yeah. The Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is now in phase 3 testing, and even before the data were out, 1 billion unconditional pre-orders have been placed by the UK, Europe and the US, and Australia's trying to get a piece of the pie as well. You're both at the University of Queensland, where Australian researchers have also been working on a candidate with federal funding. If this one works out, is it right that Australians get first dibs on this vaccine?
Quite, yeah. I mean, immediate priorities for Australians aside, is still a successful candidate will have to be produced and licensed in other areas and other countries.
And if supply was limited, you could argue that the limited supply needs to be targeted in specific hotspots before it gets distributed universally, perhaps.
That's right. Well, there's all sorts of equations. Clearly, in terms of the epidemiology of this, there's a clear case for prioritizing certain groups. You arguably should be giving it to frontline workforce, and you want to be giving it to people who are vulnerable, either in terms of what they do so that social reproduction can continue, so cleaners, bus drivers, and people in aged care.
At the moment, vaccine nationalism is really undermining equitable access to vaccines at the global level. You know, the problem won't be solved until it's solved for everyone. It won't, the world won't return to normal, the global economy won't recover, people won't be able to travel until the pandemic has resolved in all countries, not just a handful of wealthy countries. COVAX and the technology access pool are really important mechanisms for the COVID-19 pandemic. They have flaws, but they're the most promising mechanisms that we have if COVAX is actually funded sufficiently. At the moment, there are still billions more dollars that are needed. So wealthy countries simply haven't committed enough funds to ensure access for the countries that can't fund their own vaccines. And we see these wealthy countries negotiating directly with vaccine manufacturers, advance purchase agreements in order to, you know, secure access separately from the COVAX mechanism, which means they may buy up so much of the vaccine that there isn't enough left for low-income countries.
Yeah, I found it interesting that Australia had already been in negotiations with AstraZeneca before it joined the COVAX fund and paid $124 million to the COVAX fund. Do you think COVAX and the technology access pool have the potential to sort of short-circuit the whole IP regime for the future, or is it a blip?
I think the global regime that we have at the moment, where research and development is funded by providing patents, monopolies on clinical trial data and so on, is a fundamentally broken regime. It really works against what we most need in a pandemic, which is timely, affordable access to new products. And we really need to look at new ways of funding research and development. You know, we need to rethink the entire intellectual property regime. We need to rethink the way trade and investment agreements are negotiated and the types of rules that are put into them. Mechanisms like the investor-state dispute settlement process. During a pandemic, we need rapid access to new products on a large scale. And so we really need a different system.
You can hear all about a different system in the next episode. We challenge the basic premises of intellectual property, that these laws and the free market are essential for stimulating innovation. In terms of Australia's commitment to a people's vaccine, it was only late September that Australia joined the COVAX facility. A few days later, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison used his speech to the UN General Assembly to make this statement.
Whoever finds the vaccine must share it. This is a global responsibility, and it's a moral responsibility for a vaccine to be shared far and wide. Some might see short-term advantage or even profit, but I assure you, to anyone who may think along those lines, humanity will have a very long memory and be a very, very severe judge. Australia's pledge is clear. If we find the vaccine, we will share it.
It will be interesting to see whether the diplomatic pen is mightier than the sword of the market. For now, I want to thank my guests Peter Hill, Owen Williams, and Deborah Gleeson for their contribution. The views expressed are their own and may not represent those of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. To find all the references mentioned in this podcast, please go to our website, racp.edu.au/podcast. Pomegranate Health is just one of many educational resources you can find at the RACP's online resources portal, along with the recorded lectures and e-learning courses and the online Congress series of webinars. There's something for every specialty, and even a page to submit your favourite tools. If you found this podcast interesting, don't be afraid to share it with your colleagues. Many thanks. I'm Mick Capazzini.